The next case is 1798, Cincinnati Bar Association versus R. Bruce Selnick. Mr. Van Hoen.
Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court, I'm Mark Van der Laan, representing the respondent, R. Bruce Selnick, in this matter. This is not a case, I submit, where we say that Mr. Selnick was in a gray area or that there were any issues in terms of violation. Indeed, the crux of this case rests on the fact that Mr. Selnick cooperated fully with the disciplinary authority, the Cincinnati Bar Association, and through a course of painstaking negotiation engaged in between myself and Mr. Richards principally, with the full understanding of the panel chair as we went, we entered into a stipulation that addressed all issues in the case, a stipulation which was designed to comply with what was then the proposed but soon to be effective rule on stipulations, which included now the law that the disciplinary authority and respondent may stipulate as to a proposed penalty. That's what happened in this particular case. And based upon all of that information, based upon that rather lengthy and good faith negotiation, the parties reached a conclusion that the proposed penalty, indeed the agreed penalty, would be an indefinite suspension.
But did not relator assume that the respondent would comply with the stipulation, such as giving back files and that sort of thing, which he had some difficulty doing, didn't he?
He did have some difficulty doing. He's still in the process of attempting to do that. Indeed, as we've attempted to show on our motion to supplement the record on an ongoing basis, Mr. Selnick finally has I guess the terminology in the trade is hit bottom. He is undergoing a fairly extensive therapy at this point for his apparent addiction to prescribed medications. And he is, in addition, attempting to afford those former clients of his both restitution and an explanation by way of an accounting for the work that he did do. Nevertheless, the stipulation, as we presented it to the panel, I thought it was very clear that the purpose of the hearing, despite what the panel chair said at the very outset, was for their opportunity to at least meet Mr. Selnick. The issue of mitigation had already been wound into the stipulation itself. That's why the penalty was as agreed. That's what was explained to the panel chair throughout. Bar counsel made it very clear that this was designed from their perspective to make sure that Mr. Selnick stopped practicing at the present time, that it was appropriate, and that it covered the issues that were then before the Cincinnati Bar Association. Notwithstanding that, the panel and ultimately the board made additional determinations that for some reason Mr. Selnick did not show appropriate remorse. I submit, and the transcript is before the court, we have referenced it, he did show remorse. Indeed, the whole point of, I think, a full and complete stipulation and acknowledgement of responsibility demonstrates that. Did he express some frustration of his difficulty with clients? Yes, he did. Did he express some concern about whether he would ever practice law again? Yes, he did.
Is it your feeling that the remorse issue is what moved it from indefinite suspension to disbarment?
I have to believe that, Justice Douglas.
Nothing else.
I cannot glean from the report and recommendation much more than that, because we had stipulated everything, not virtually everything. We had stipulated everything. And I was led to believe that the bar would stand by that stipulation even as we stand here today, but I guess I was mistaken.
I'm sorry, were you finished?
I read the stipulations, and the report that they give us from the entire case is very short compared to everything that went into the case before that.
We attempted, as one can see, I don't want to minimize the various defaults in this case of Mr. Selleck that are included in the complaint, but they could be very fact-intensive. We could have been in hearings for not just days, but perhaps weeks on some of the issues that were at stake. His conduct fell below the standards that we would all expect. But notwithstanding all of that, in view of this court's pronouncements time and time again, and we've attempted to address just those in our brief, which cover the decade of the 90s, and frankly as recently as the pronouncements of the last couple weeks, which have come out since the briefing, it seems apparent, at least to this council, that the conduct in this situation is the sort of conduct that merits typically indefinite suspension.
Let me, Mr. Mendelon, let me go back. I think remorse is a very important issue in a case like this. The panel says that he does not really believe that he did anything wrong in his misuse of client funds. His basic sense of right and wrong appears to be missing. I want to give you a chance to respond to that, but
fine.
If that's true, then why wouldn't we assume that this is a person who has simply chosen the wrong profession and not give the person a chance? I mean, usually we give a person a chance to come back. We take your license, but we think there's some redeeming value. If you are remorseful, if you say, I'm sorry, I'll never do this again, I understand I made a mistake, then we as licensors will take a risk with that person. But the person says, they take the client's funds, abuse the client, and essentially their attitude is, I don't think I did anything wrong. Why would we say, well, okay, we'll give you a chance while you're not practicing law to somehow prove to us that you understand the importance of the responsibility that you have? That's the issue.
Fair question.
That's what remorse is to me.
It's
a very
question.
Important issue.
And I think the remorse, for an individual to stipulate everything in this case, I think without anything else shows remorse. One wouldn't do that. One would not cooperate so fully with the authorities if there were no remorse. One would not have counsel negotiate and work through with bar counsel over months this sort of conclusion. Furthermore, one can look mightily at the transcript of the hearing in this matter, and it simply does not come through from anything that Mr. Selleck said in response to questions. The panel seemed troubled when asked, when Mr. Selleck was asked, what are you going to do with your life? How are you going to support yourself? And his response was, I don't know. To me, that's about the most honest answer that an attorney in his situation can give.
But that's not remorse, is it? How is that remorse? I don't know.
That's not remorse.
I take my license. I don't know what I'm going to do. That's not, I'm very sorry for what I did. I realize I did something terribly wrong to these clients.
And he did say that.
Okay. Well, then we'll find it in the transcript.
Yes.
He
accepts responsibility. And we refer to specific portions of that.
That's what I'm interested in seeing and determining whether disbarment is appropriate or indefinite suspension, frankly.
But on the other hand, we have seen situations in this court where counsel, the attorney in question, chose not even to show up or appear for anything or to stipulate anything at all. Nevertheless, particularly when the first matter, when it was the first matter before this court, indefinite suspension was the result. So in the context, in the framework of how this court has viewed cases of this nature over the years up to, as I say, even July of this year, indefinite suspension has been the way, and I think the fair way, to deal with lawyers in this situation.
What is the condition of his health? Is he still suffering?
He is still in treatment.
He's still on methadone?
He has been, if I understand the statement of his counselor, I believe he has been weaned from all medications at the moment.
So he's not taking any pain
medication? He's not taking pain medication of any sort at this point. He is attending meetings daily and therapy sessions daily as well. He is surprised that he can cope without pain medication because it had been prescribed for such a long period of time.
I thought I heard you earlier say that as you stand here today, you're a bit confused that the Bar Association doesn't seem to be standing by the stipulation of indefinite suspension. Did I understand that correctly or misunderstand?
Yes.
That?
No, that was certainly my reading of the memorandum that they filed with this court.
Well, I read the conclusion differently than that. So
I understand what the conclusion says, Your Honor.
Well, you're telling me the conclusion that they put in their brief is not something that they're... I mean, we're going to hear something else in a little while, as you're going to tell me.
Given the rest of the brief, that as I read it, it didn't seem to me that it was saying we believe that this is the appropriate penalty because we have agreed to it and worked through it with counsel.
Well, it says this stipulation stands even though the board found, quote, his basic sense of right and wrong appears to be missing. Now, that sounds to me like they're abiding by the agreement. And if you're telling me that, well, I guess we'll just have to wait and see.
If that's the case, then I will accept that as what their position
is. That says, isn't it?
That's what the final sentence says. I agree, Your Honor. Again, I would come back to the case law that this court has developed over a substantial period of time. I submit that Mr. Selnick was remorseful. He frankly looked like a mess at the hearing, and I think that helped demonstrate the remorse. Perhaps they viewed it differently. And this is a situation where perhaps Chief Justice Moyer, as you asked, should he be practicing law at this time? He should not be practicing law. I think we agree with that. But the issue is, should he be given the opportunity to get his life in order over some period of time in order to reassess that at some point in the future be able to address this court and say, yes, I believe I have done that which is essential to practice law in this state and wish to be reinstated. The permanence of a permanent disbarment, I think, is not warranted. I have a reserved time.
Thank you, Mr. Vanderlaan. Ms. Dalla.
May it please the court. I'm Naomi Dalla, and Gates Richards and I are representing the Cincinnati Bar Association in this grievance in which the board has recommended permanent disbarment of Mr. Selnick. If I could first address the issue of remorse. One of the items of aggravation in assessing a penalty is whether there's been a refusal to acknowledge the wrongful nature of conduct. At page 4 of the board's recommendation, they find that Mr. Selnick seemed to hold many of his clients responsible for his problems. That is, rather than himself. They concluded, the panel itself concluded, that respondent handled client funds and his professional responsibilities under the principle that he did whatever he needed to do according to his own rules and perceptions. That's also at page 4. Those are his rules and perceptions rather than the disciplinary rules under which he should have served. At page 5 of the board's recommendation, they state the panel concluded that respondent does not really believe that he did anything wrong in his misuse of client funds. That goes directly to the issue of remorse. If I might also address...
Counsel?
Yes, ma'am.
There. Am I on? Okay. When I read that, I was a little concerned because it didn't seem to match the stipulations at all. So I went back to the record and read what he testified to after the stipulations were entered into. I'd like to read you some sentences from the record. This is him. He's offering what he says are explanations. His statements are, you know, I'm not here to make an excuse for this. Things happen, but I'm not here to tell you that it's not my responsibility. Answer, I didn't handle things properly. It's obvious. I've had health problems. Then he goes into that. Answer, oh, yeah, I didn't handle it right. I'm not telling you that. Answer, you know, I'm not here to make excuses. I am where I am. Answer, other than I did it improperly, not really. I'm not sure. Answer, I'm not here to give excuses. If you want to hear explanations, I'll tell you. It's my responsibility. Answer, I'm not trying to offer an excuse. Let me back off. This is my responsibility. If you think that's an excuse, it's not. When I read all these explanations, it sounded to me like what the panel did, and it was grilling him in a really tough way, which I can't blame them for considering what he did. They seemed to take every explanation he gave and say that he had no remorse because he was explaining why he did what he did. But it was clear to me that he's not blaming clients, he's blaming himself, he's accepting responsibility. That doesn't square with that statement. How do you square that record with their conclusion that he said he did not do anything wrong? I mean, they're the absolute opposite.
Well, I believe those questions in the record came when he started to describe his chemical dependency, and one of the four elements of mitigation in chemical dependency is that it caused the conduct. So I believe the panel was trying to ascertain what was the cause of his conduct.
And he explains it, but he consistently, as I read to you over and over, says, you know, I'm not making excuses, I'm at fault, I did it, I'm responsible. And that simply doesn't square with the conclusion that they reached.
I believe they were looking for a root cause. What is it in you, Mr. Selnick, that caused you to fail in fulfilling your professional responsibilities against these 12 grievances? What is it in you, Mr. Selnick, that caused you to take over $100,000 of Janet Lee's money?
What did they want from him beyond what he said? What were they looking for beyond, it is my fault?
Well, they could have been looking for, I abused drugs and that caused me to lose my judgment. Something other than, I took out a Yellow Pages ad that was too expensive and I had too much pressure and I did what I thought I needed to do, but somehow it wasn't enough.
He's giving explanations, but he says they're not excuses and they don't justify it.
Perhaps they found his explanations
not
without merit.
Honest.
Well, perhaps since they were reviewing his demeanor, they found him to be not credible. They certainly reached a conclusion of great emphasis. The language of the board recommendation carries forward the power of the findings of the panel, which were serious multiple violations resulting in the most severe sanction beyond that which the parties had stipulated.
So we should ignore his spoken word and go on his demeanor that doesn't match his spoken word? Is that what they do?
No, I'm suggesting that the panel should reach a decision based on all the evidence, including his testimony. Look at his testimony, look at the matters that were stipulated, look at the wrongs that were inflicted by him. Look at the numerous defalcations of his. Look at his failure to serve answers. Look at the cases dismissed under his stewardship. Look at the files not returned. Look at the accountings not provided. Look at all of the conduct and weigh it and reach a determination. And it seems they reached...
That's determining on based on his conduct. That's not a determination based on lack of remorse.
Well, it's a determination based upon whether there's enough mitigating or aggravating elements to deviate from the recommended sanction. Certainly the power to assess a sanction lies with the panel, the board, and with this court. It's up to them to review the evidence as presented and reach that determination, which they did. I would like to now address the motion for order supplementing the record that was filed and served on us yesterday afternoon. I'd simply like to state that what was presented is not part of the record below, and I would like a chance to give the court the other side of that story. There are two elements presented. One is a letter on treatment. It does not indicate that that treatment followed an indictment on June 13th of this year for alleged forging of prescriptions, an alleged violation of Ohio Revised Code 2925.23B1F4, two counts of Schedule II drugs, a fourth degree felony, and that Mr. Selnick has since been arraigned for that, and that none of the four required elements on the mitigative effect of chemical dependency are indicated in that filing. Those are a diagnosis by a qualified professional. There's no diagnosis in that letter. A determination that the dependency contributed to the misconduct. In fact, we have an express finding to the contrary. The board stated he was unwilling to attribute any of his professional problems to his physical problems. The third required element for mitigation in chemical dependency is a certificate of successful completion of an approved program that has not occurred. And finally, a prognosis from a qualified professional that the attorney is able to return to ethical practice under specified conditions.
And all of this adds up to an indefinite suspension, which is your recommendation.
Our recommendation, as agreed, is an indefinite suspension. However, we're aware of the many elements that have happened since we entered into that. We expected Mr. Selnick to honor it. You're right, Justice Moyer, that was a reasonable expectation that he would uphold his promise. No, I'm sorry, you asked Mr. Vandalon, was that not a reasonable expectation that he would uphold his promise? We had that expectation. We had it on January 17th when he signed the stipulations. We thought he meant what he said. We had it on February 23rd when, under oath at the hearing, he looks three panel members in the eye and says, yes, I will, with assistance as need be, inventory my files. I will return them to the clients. I will make an accounting to my clients. I will return retainers that haven't been used yet. He said he would do that within 60 days. Those 60 days ran on April 24th. It hasn't happened. It hasn't happened in the interim. Not a penny has been refunded. Not a file has been returned.
Well, does the Cincinnati bar change its recommendation then, or would the bar object to a disbarment?
The bar does not object to a disbarment. It does uphold its recommendation since we signed it. However, we recognize this court's ultimate authority in setting a sentence. And we also recognize everything that's transpired since we entered into that stipulation. We didn't expect him not to tell the truth at the hearing. We didn't expect him to swear to return files and not do it.
Why would your position be, well, at the time we signed a stipulation that was based on facts at that time, but now, based upon other evidence, we think he should be disbarred? You're not going that far. I don't want to make you do that, but why not?
Because we made an express representation to Mr. Vandalon that we would stand by the stipulation regardless of what the recommendation was from the panel and the board. In order to get him to agree to the stipulation, the important thing to us was to get Mr. Selnick off the streets, to get him to stop hurting clients, to get people to stop calling the Bar Association with requests for investigation, to get the funds back in the client's hands, the files back in the hands of competent counsel, and to get these people protected. So for us, it was worth it to admit to a lesser sanction than we knew we could establish.
I said our inquiry ought to be with regard to protecting clients. That's really the most important thing to me. Has that been done? Are the clients' files properly delivered to competent counsel?
To our knowledge, not a single piece of paper has been returned. Angela Rosenbaum, for instance, one of the 12 grievances in this case, has taken the action of retaining separate counsel to file a Replevin case. And I have before me a default judgment that was entered.
Okay, well, you've answered the question. Why would not you then seek from us some plenary order to require this?
Well, in terms of expediency, we felt that the better thing to do was to follow this case to its conclusion, especially with the recommendation we received here. We considered an interim remedial suspension and instead got Mr. Selnick at the hearing to agree to stop practicing then. We have gone over in our mind various strategies and the best way to manage this, and this was the course we chose.
Yeah, well, I understand why you did that and how it happened, but this has been a long time, and that's got to be cold comfort to the clients who can't get their files back.
Exactly. Cold comfort to the clients, cold comfort to their counsel, cold comfort to his malpractice insurer, who's paying out six-figure settlements.
Well, maybe we better ask his counsel what he's going to do about that, because to me that's the important fact in the case.
If I could continue in response to the motion for order supplementing the record, the first piece of the puzzle that wasn't brought to the court's attention was the criminal indictment. The second piece of the puzzle that hasn't been brought to the court's attention is the Rodney and Crystal Trent agreement to repay $13,200. And what Mr. Selnick says in the pleading is he's obtained the funds to commence providing restitution, not that he's paid dollar one. The Trent number is more than a random amount. It's the exact amount that a Hamilton County probate magistrate found on August 15th of this year that Mr. Selnick had embezzled from the trust estate of a minor. That's a $12,000 refund due his client plus a 10% penalty. The magistrate's decision refers that matter to a prosecutor under Ohio Revised Code 2106.26. This is a case in which Mr. Selnick obtained a personal injury settlement for a minor, which needed probate court approval. He failed to disperse the funds properly in the hospital, which had rendered care to the minor client grievant, later obtained a default judgment against that client for $7,649, and that occurred in December of 1999. And then the third element that isn't brought to light in Mr. Selnick's pleadings, he agrees to make accountings to eight clients. There's seven clients in this case alone for which no agreement is offered, one of those being Angela Rosenbaum. She's the individual who obtained the default judgment against him in the Replevin action. A court ordered possessory control of the files returned to her on July 15th of this year. That's her own divorce file and two personal injury files for her minor son. No compliance has been made by Mr. Selnick. So he's given you less than one half of the picture in this motion for order supplementing the record. With respect to the elements of aggravation that are presented here that support the penalty of permanent disbarment, under Rule 10A1, there's a dishonest or selfish motive. The board found that Mr. Selnick, in securing and retaining client funds to shore up what appeared to be an ongoing Ponzi scheme. The board didn't use that phrase lightly. It used it for effect. It used it to convey the power and the extent of the violations of the code in this case and the need for this penalty. A pattern of misconduct. The board found a multiplicity of offenses. Mr. Selnick admitted violating multiple disciplinary rules. A lack of cooperation in the grievance process. Mr. Vanderlaan has cited Mr. Selnick's cooperation. He cooperated when it came to signing the stipulations as negotiated by counsel. He has not cooperated one whit in complying with the promises he made there. He signed those stipulations on January 17th. He made the promise again under oath at the hearing on February 23rd with a 60-day limit, which ran in April. He has not complied since. He's refused to acknowledge the wrongful nature of his conduct. There is vulnerability and harm to his clients. For instance, Mr. Miller, whose wrongful discharge case was dismissed for failure to serve the defendant. Mr. Selnick didn't respond to discovery in the second case he filed on Mr. Miller's behalf. He didn't respond to a motion to compel. He didn't respond to a motion to dismiss. He did not respond to a motion for summary judgment. He did not respond to discovery motions. Summary judgment was granted with prejudice against his client. He didn't serve his motion to set that judgment aside, and he didn't provide a supporting memorandum of law. Janet Lee. Mr. Selnick obtained for her $109,121 in personal injury settlements. She made four separate written requests of him to repay her those proceeds and give her an accounting. And what she received were checks written on his business account for insufficient funds and an incomplete accounting. Her lawsuit was settled by his malpractice carrier for over $100,000. With respect to mitigation, many of these same elements work against him. An absence of...
I've read all that. It's all here, isn't it?
It's all there and then some, Your Honor. It's there in great depth, and that's what merits this penalty.
You do tell us the then some. We've got, it's really all here.
Well, I won't belabor that point. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Allen. Mr. Vanderlaan, you've saved a little over 2 minutes of your time.
Mr. Vanderlaan, a lot of what we've heard today really isn't in the record.
No, it's not, and frankly, it's not even known to me.
And your motion is not even in my file yet. But if any of that is true, I assume we'll be getting a second case involving your client, will we not?
Mr. Salnick is... I don't want to talk about my own personal experience, but attempting to work with somebody who is chemically dependent or is under the influence even of prescription medications is a very difficult task.
I understand.
He has started the effort. And indeed, when Ms. Dallab argues about not making restitution, well, the money is has been set aside because it's sitting in the Dinsmore and Scholl trust account to be paid out as soon as the check clears, and it's not from Mr. Salnick, so I know it will clear. He is making those efforts which he is capable of making. In terms of a variety of things that came up apart from the record, I'm not aware of them.
Do we need a mental health suspension? I mean, there's always that option in the file. If somebody is so mentally ill that they need to be taken out for no other reason than a mental health suspension.
I'm not sure that it would... I'm not sure it makes a difference, to be honest with you.
You didn't even know of the indictment at this point.
Well, I knew that he had been indicted, but it was in a diversion program. And so long as he is doing the work that he is currently doing, there will be no prosecution.
I, too, am thinking out loud. Supposing we found it necessary to... He's here today, so he'll love my suggestion, I'm sure, that we appoint disciplinary counsel immediately. We order him to proceed to Cincinnati to gather all the files, order your client to comply with that, have him distribute the files, and without compliance within 24 or 48 hours, then we have a new case and it's contempt. That might get the attention.
Your Honor, it's not an issue of getting his attention. I think the issue is his capability of responding.
Go into where the files are.
We had to do that
in Toledo with a lawyer. We just went right into his office and got them.
Well, they're at his home now. So, yeah, that can be done.
So it sounds as if the files, he has the files.
He has
it's
files.
It's a matter of his being able to process them and get them in order and get them
correct.
In the mail, I guess, literally, to be
yes.
able to do the... Which somebody, I would think, from actually the Cincinnati Bar could probably do that.
I'm aware of actually two files that people have requested that I've discussed with him about the need to get them to those people.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
The case is submitted. You will be advised of our opinion.